why were warnings ignored about a crumbling high-rise along the Florida coast? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the latest on the investigation into the Surfside building collapse in South Florida and what it means for Oceanside construction up here. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, the most Instagrammable place in town. We'll take a peek inside the new selfie world, Jack's, opening this month. But first this hour, new state, even federal legislation could soon be proposed to address construction or engineering issues after the deadly condominium building collapse in Surfside in South Florida. Crews there continue to search the rubble for survivors this morning as a forensic examination gets underway, too. The Champlain Tower South collapsed early Thursday. As of midday Monday, the death toll had reached 11, with 151 people still accounted for. The tragedy could have far-ranging implications for the building industry in Florida and the nation, and that, of course, includes our corner of the state. Michael Bure is founder and president of Bure Construction Group in Fleming Island, and he has recently been reappointed for a second year to the Florida Building Commission. Bure is also a past president of the Florida Home Builders Association. He's on the line. Michael, so good to have your insights this morning. Good morning.
Melissa, good morning. Thank you for having me.
And as we talk about the Surfside building collapse, what are your questions and thoughts? New legislation could be proposed to prevent this kind of tragedy from happening again. We'll go to your calls in a little bit. The number to join us, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Well, Michael, as I mentioned, the search for survivors is going on yet more this morning, although relatives' hopes are fading. At the same time, the Associated Press is reporting that an engineering report from 2018 looking into this building found that the ground floor pool deck of the condo high-rise was resting on a concrete slab that needed to be repaired. There was apparently cracking of concrete columns, beams, and walls in the parking garage. The condo owners were facing assessments for millions of dollars worth of repairs. Finding all of this out in hindsight is just gutting, of course, to those who've lost loved ones. So if I could get your professional insights into this, where did things go wrong with oversight and repair work that was needed on this building?
Well, absolutely. First and foremost, our thoughts and our prayers are with the families and the first responders. Obviously, a very difficult situation. As general contractors, we build structures to hopefully stand the test of time. And so when these things happen, they're shocked not only to the community, but certainly as builders as well. So I guess I need to step back though and just talk for a moment about the way the Florida Building Code came about. So this structure is 40 years old. We did not have a Florida Building Code 40 years ago. The Florida Building Code Study Commission was established in 1996. The first Florida Building Code, the law creating the first building code, was enacted by the Florida legislature in 1998 and became effective March 1st of 2002. Mm. So our Florida Building Code dates back to 2002, and all of that is a result of Hurricane Andrew.
Sure.
And the effects that had and the quality of construction. So just to kind of build a little bit of a baseline for the listeners to understand that what we're building today is absolutely not what we built 40 years ago or even 20 years ago. I think it's important. And of course, we're up to our seventh edition of the Florida Building Code that just became effective January 1st, 2021. So we're always continuing, or the state of Florida is always continuing to enhance our Florida Building Code, adjusting it to current materials means and methods. So I think it's important for the listeners to just understand that there's a huge difference between this structure built 40 years ago and certainly how we're building today. There are some concerning reports to answer your question about the structural engineering. And I would say that, you know, any specific discussion of any regulation or legislation changes to prevent this from happening again is premature. Until we understand how this happened, what created this. There's a full forensic study that has to be conducted now to uncover any structural or performance issues, which will be done by the audit. And then based on that actual information, we will be able to make adjustments. And I will take my hat off to our governor, who was on the scene almost immediately and has done a great job in staying completely plugged into what is best for our Florida citizens. And so I think that answers your question, Melissa, but please.
Sure. 549-2937, and we'll go to your calls in a moment. There's a new wrinkle we learned this morning. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, that's an agency of the U.S. Department of Commerce, is joining in the structural review of this collapse that's being conducted by the town of Surfside and Miami-Dade County. A federal agency reviewing this, they typically investigate damage from such things as the September 11th attacks or Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. We could be seeing new federal law related to building construction and code enforcement decisions here in Florida. But as you said, Michael, we do need more information. Now, they're going to look at potential foundational defects in the pool area of this condo, high-rise in Surfside, other structural issues. New reports this morning, new pictures that have been posted online of how the pool area looked before the building collapsed. Looked pretty bad. It was clear that repairs were needed to this building. Can you speak to that? Now, as you said, this was built in an era before we had modern Florida building codes, but why was this building allowed to drift? You know, not why was this building allowed to let these repairs slide? And what should the state be doing in that vein to make sure that buildings are not slipping through the cracks, you know, literally and figuratively, when they're not keeping repairs up to date and keeping people that live in the buildings safe?
So, you know, life safety concern is always the driving factor in anything we build, whether it's a single family home, whether it's a multifamily structure, or whether it's a high-rise office building. Life safety is always the key component that we or the designers, I should say, always take into consideration means of egress, structural time it takes to go from the farthest point to a point where somebody can leave the structure. And so all of that is taken into consideration. But there is, again, a full forensic analysis that's going to have to take place, and that is going to take place. And so we have so many great professionals in our country and in our state. The state of Florida is chock full of just highly qualified individuals. And so I think a meeting of that group, bringing everybody together, all the ideas, once we have all the physical data, once we have the actual, understanding of what took place, whether it was a soil erosion problem, whether it was a concrete structure problem, whether it was a steel in the concrete structure problem, whether it was its proximity to another water source. There are so many components that could have created this environment. So right now it's all speculation.
Yeah, all speculation.
The focus and it.
Sure.
I'm sorry, Melissa, go ahead.
Oh, no problem. Another question that's floating through my mind is that as you're talking, I'm picturing listeners out at the beaches who live in buildings very similar to the one that collapsed in South Florida, and they're wondering about their buildings. Can you explain how codes and inspections here work in Jacksonville as they are compared to South Florida? Because it's my understanding that the codes in Miami are even stricter in the wake of Hurricane Andrew. Can you enlighten us a little bit about possible differences around the state?
Yes, ma'am. So South Florida has a higher wind load than other parts of the state. Certainly coastal areas typically carry that same higher wind load, and the structures are designed by structural engineers to be able to withstand those wind loads. Now, you know, one of the things to understand is everything starts with the foundation of any structure. And when we're building, high-rise structures, of course, we follow the structural engineering to a T, But typically that will come with deep pile foundations and grade beams that tie all those piles together. And that's what creates the mat that supports the structure. So then the question is, did they have deep pile foundations on the structure? And what type of foundations were they? Were they compaction piles? Were they friction piles? There's several different types. And so how was it bearing the weight? If, in fact, it turns out that that is the issue, then it'll be a full diagnostic to figure out how deep those piles were, how big they were, whether the steel inside those piles were still intact or whether they eroded. So there's a lot of questions, again, all part of that. Now, when you look at North Florida, structural engineering is structural engineering. Other than wind loads on a structure, the compaction stress, the tensile stress, the shear stress, it all goes into the design that the structural engineer computes when they're giving us our structural engineering plans that we build from. And so that across the board is fairly universal, unless you're talking about seismic loads out west in California. Certainly here it's hurricane load, so we're looking at wind load, and all that comes into play. So to say that we have any kind of a problem across the state of Florida is a way overreach. Mm. Our buildings are built very sound, very structurally sound. And again, this is a 40-year-old structure. We have to find out how this was built, what it was built with, the means and methods it was built from, to be able to determine why this specific case failed, as opposed to the hundreds and hundreds of high-rise buildings we have along our coast, which are performing quite perfectly.
We're talking,
So I think that answers your question.
We're talking to Michael Beret. He is a Fleming Island resident, owns a construction company, and is on the Florida Building Commission. What are your questions about the investigation into the Surfside building collapse in South Florida? 549-2937. Eric is in Arlington. Hello, Eric. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. I'm guessing that your guest is from the South. He just yes ma'amed you a few minutes ago.
So. Yeah, right. I know. Okay, when I first moved here and people started calling me ma'am, I thought, do I look old or something? What's going on here?
No,
it's very polite.
Yeah, people your own age, when you get yes sir and yes ma'am by people your own age, you're dealing with people from the South for sure. Not there's anything wrong with that, of course. But two things. I've been following this pretty closely. I just wanted to make have a comment and observation. The maintenance guy that worked at the Surfside building between 1995 and 2000 said that the basement parking, I guess it was under the pool or somewhere in that area, was constantly inundated with salt water. And they had pumps in there, and they were constantly pumping water out. And he said there was lots of times he went in there, and the water would be gone by the time he went in there. Sometimes they couldn't pump it out fast enough. They'd have to replace the pumps. But there were other times they went in there, and the water was gone. And he made the observation that, you just always wonder, well, where did the water go? And so, coincidentally, there's another building not too far up the coast from there that was built by the same contractor, same materials and all that stuff. And it doesn't, from what I understand, it doesn't have any of the same earmarks that or problem areas that the Surfside building had. So my comment is this. In a week where Ron DeSantis brought up how communism is evil, it looks like two factors of capitalism created this problem. Number one, climate change, which caused a sea level rise, which caused the saltwater inundation. And two, profit motive. These people knew in 2018, they had an inspection, and they knew that that building had been compromised, and they didn't say anything about it. Why? Because they were afraid of losing all that money.
You're talking the owners of the building. Okay, let's take these questions one by one, Michael. Let's begin with the issue of saltwater erosion. Now, we don't know yet, let's be clear, whether that was a deciding or contributing factor into this collapse, but it does bring up an existential question for Florida and all of the building that we have along the coast. This building was on land that had been sinking, we're told, for some time. We have beautiful high rises all up and down the coast that are going to be imperiled by water rise and saltwater erosion. And so as a builder, What are your thoughts about how, as a state, we can start to become more proactive about this? Because this is only going to become more of an issue over time.
No, it's an excellent question. I will share with you that sea level rise is something that the state of Florida has had on the radar for quite some time now. I also sit on the Regional Planning Council for Northeast Florida, and it has been a topic of discussion for several years now. Each local county has the opportunity to grant money to be able to do their own studies and determine how sea level rise is going to affect their specific community. And so I would offer that, you know, our elected officials have already identified this as a long-term issue or problem for our state, and they're already taking corrective action to make sure that we can stay out in front of it as much as we can. But, you know, to Eric's point, it is an issue. It is something that we do need to manage as best we can. Granted, you know, that it's Mother Nature that we're basically designing against to protect our towns and our cities along the coast. And yes, Eric, just a side comment, a little Southern hospitality, which is where I come from the South. So
yeah.
A yes sir and a yes ma'am is certainly in my diction.
Certainly so. In your vocabulary. What about his other comment that the owners of this building were negligent, that they knew for years that, you know, that repairs were needed? Here's a tweet from a listener. Yes, building codes are stronger since Andrew, but enforcement is everything. Florida law allows builders to hire their own inspectors to certify the quality of construction. Michael Bure, is that something that could change in the wake of this disaster?
You know, I don't think so. You know, that'll certainly be up to the governor and the building commission, but when private inspectors are hired, they're vetted. These are very highly qualified individuals. And the reason why private inspectors are hired is because the counties could not keep up with the load of construction in our state. And so the option to be able to bring in a private inspector who is fully certified to provide those inspections became paramount. In addition to that, the private inspectors are not the end all. The counties still have the ability, and most will follow behind those private inspectors to check the inspections as well. So there's a quality control component here that the county still has their hands around and will always have their hands around to make sure that structures are built soundly.
Here's an email from Eve. When someone buys a condo, they normally have the home inspected as part of their mortgage. Is there a requirement for the building to be checked? You know, it's my understanding that particularly in South Florida, there are so many cash buyers for these kinds of oceanfront units that they can bypass all of that. And that could have also contributed to the problem. What are your thoughts about that?
You know, I think, you know, hiring a private inspector, you know, is certainly always a good element of due diligence when a buyer is looking to invest in a piece of property. So, you know, if somebody chooses to build something or purchase a piece of property for cash and forego any private inspectors, that's certainly their option. And you know, that's their choice. But, you know, I personally would always encourage somebody, you know, if there is any concern, you know, certainly hire a private inspector and have them come on behalf of the owner to do a full review of the property. Most inspections are a visual inspection. Typically, they don't get into any destructive testing to test concrete strength and compaction or steel tensile strength. They don't get into those type of testing typically in a private inspector. It's a little bit more of a cosmetic and then a review of the MEPs, the mechanical, electrical, and plumbing systems. But I would always encourage somebody, if you're going to invest in a piece of property, invest in the due diligence prior to purchasing it.
Here's a tweet from Nan. What is the wisdom of building new structures with parking garages on the waterfront? Most cities are retreating, allowing nature to help with a buffer. And so I know this isn't necessarily where your head is at as a builder, Michael, but over time, aren't more Florida cities going to have to consider this idea of managed retreat, building away from the coast, rather than continuing to build along the coast? And I say this with the caveat that we don't know yet the full cause of this disaster. But this is a question that's going to become more urgent over time in this state.
So I don't necessarily agree with that last statement. I think that, you know, Florida is known for its coastline. And so our job as general contractors and certainly a member of the Florida Building Commission is to build structures that can soundly occupy the area that, that we're building in. And so if we do find out that there is some issue that is not something we've already prevented in the new code, and I just want to restress that. This is a 40-year-old structure, and our code went into effect, the latest revision went into effect March 1st, 2002, but it didn't actually get put in place. The Florida Building Code was put in place in 1998. I'm sorry, it went effective in 2002. Our current one is 2021. But, you know, so we design for the environments that, we build. Our structural engineers and architects design for the environments that they're building that structure within. And so to say that we're going to retreat from the Florida coast because of this one issue or this one situation, I think is an overreach.
No, I agree with you. I don't think that this disaster is a bellwether necessarily for the whole concept of managed retreat overall. I guess what I'm saying is that in the coming decades, buildings are going to be threatened in other ways, from rising water, saltwater erosion, and is it responsible in the long term not to be thinking more about that? And it's a question that's sort of separate from this disaster, really.
Sure. And I would say that that it is always under consideration. We're always reviewing, always looking at new data, always making adjustments to the Florida Building Code specifically. I mean, every year we review new amendments to the code, which is what creates the new code. And so we'll bring in data from local counties all over the state. That data will be reviewed, and then it will be implemented. If it's approved, it'll be implemented as a statewide standard. And so that's how we continue to make that adjustment, make our code better. And that's why, you know, from when the code was first enacted in 2002 to now 2021, our code has gone through 7 major revisions. And that is no small feat. That's where the general contractor and the building contractor and all the subcontractors have to review and then potentially change how they do what they do to make sure that we are adhering to the latest and greatest techniques and material usages. And you know, one thing that I do want to share as well is we have a Florida product approval process in the state of Florida. We're one of the few states that have this. And that is every component that goes into the structure, whether it's a high rise down to a single family home, it is reviewed. It goes through intense testing to make sure that it meets the design criteria that it says it can. And then it gets approved to be used in the state of Florida. It is a very unique process that we have in our state to make sure that the product that we build is going to stand for as long as possible. And so it's a very unique process and another checks and balances that our state has.
Mark is on the line. Hi, Mark. You're on the air. Go ahead. Go ahead, Mark.
Hey, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I was just going to make a comment. A friend of mine purchased a condominium in Auburn, Alabama recently. And when they went to close, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had enacted a new insurance policy mandate that basically said if something happens to the condo and it depreciates the value of the condo, then this particular insurance policy would come into play. And I just kind of wonder what that's going to do to the condo values down there as it relates to mortgages, things like that. You know, you have this horrible tragedy that occurred in other condominiums around there. If people are trying to sell them, I'd imagine, man, their values have taken a hit, maybe to the point where people say, I'm never going to be able to sell it. I'm not comfortable living here. I'm just walking a rip away from the place. And I didn't know if that was a discussion that anybody was having from, an economic level as it relates to the condos down there.
Sure. So the whole idea of property values along the coast, Michael, and as we wait for new legislation around this, there may be some effort to reassure people, because that is a valid concern for a lot of property owners in this state. What are your thoughts?
Well, absolutely. Mark certainly brings up a good point. I think that as they start to uncover the causes of what happened in Surfside, it will provide clarity into if there is, additional testing. This is one of the things that our governor had actually mentioned. There's going to be that 40-year window, maybe gets reduced. Maybe there's additional testing, maybe even some destructive testing to make sure that every one of the structures that we have, especially along the coastline, is performing based on its design. I think once we've confirmed, first off, what the specific issue is at Surfside with that structure, and then making sure that it's not a systemic problem in that area and then across the state, then certainly homeowners will become very confident again. It's probably a little shaken right now. I certainly understand that. That would be human nature. But building the confidence by real data and real information, making sure people understand that the structure they're in is performing the way it was designed.
Yeah, sure. And as you said, counties have final authority, but certainly there's room for inspection chiefs to be more robust in their inspections and in their enforcement. I think we've learned that. Michael Bure of the Florida Building Commission and Bure Construction Group in Fleming Island, thanks for your time today.
Absolutely. Melissa, thank you so much.
Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, the most Instagrammable new place in Jacksonville. But up next.
Never pay the first bill until you have checked that bill to make sure that it is fair and to make sure that it's accurate.
Skyrocketing healthcare costs affect us all. Up next, the author of Never Pay the First Bill gives you a roadmap to fight back. That's next. Americans consistently call the cost of healthcare their number one financial concern. We pay about twice as much per person than the citizens of other developed nations, yet millions of Americans are still uninsured or underinsured. It can be an incredibly frustrating situation dealing with these costs. In his new book, Never Pay the First Bill and Other Ways to Fight the Healthcare System and Win, award-winning ProPublica reporter Marshall Allen provides us a step-by-step guide to show what you can do to make sure you're not being overcharged. Take a listen. Hi, Marshall. Good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Great to talk to you, Melissa.
I know so many listeners are going to want to know everything you need to know about this, including me, because I've paid some medical bills that I felt were unfair. When we talk about your book, the title is really what grabs everyone. Never pay the first bill. That's one insight out of many you share. But let's begin with that. The first piece of advice you give people, not to pay the bill right away. Why not?
Right, that's right. So the principle there is not that we want to avoid paying our medical bills, right? Mm-hmm. But what we want to do is never pay the first bill until you have checked that bill to make sure that it is fair and to make sure that it's accurate. And the way you do that is when you get a medical bill, make sure they send you an itemized medical bill, especially hospitals. They're very accustomed to sending you like a lump sum payment. And that's not something that we would tolerate from, a grocery store or a car mechanic or a fast food restaurant. We need to see an itemized list of the charges so that we can see each thing that we're being billed for. Medical experts who review bills say that most of them contain errors. And it's very common, I've seen this with my own family and with other bills I've reviewed for patients, to have charges on those bills for things that did not even occur. So there is so much sloppiness and chaos in the billing system that they're not really paying attention. And the patient is the one who can tell whether those charges are accurate. The second thing you want to do with that itemized bill is make sure that it's priced fairly. And it's really important when you get the itemized bill to get the billing codes included. Those billing codes should be readily available from your hospital billing department or your doctor's billing department, or you can also get those from your insurance plan if you have an insurance plan. When you get the billing codes and the description for each service that you are charged for, you can look on, there's a website called fairhealthconsumer.org. Mm. That will give you the average insurance paid prices in your community. You can also look on hospital websites. Hospitals are now required by the federal government to post prices for all the different services they provide.
Oh, really?
So, yes. So this started in January 1st of this year. And you can go now on hospital websites. Sometimes they make it very hard to find. Mm-hmm. So you will have to be persistent in some cases. And you will see, though, that they give you the cash price. And if you have those billing codes in the description, you can look up the cash price. You can look up the Medicare price. You can look up the negotiated prices for every different insurance plan at that hospital. And then you can see if the rate that they're charging you is fair compared to what other patients at that same hospital are paying. And my argument is there is no reason that you should demand that one patient pay exponentially more for the same service than another. And that's how our healthcare system has gotten away with overcharging us.
Yeah.
They make patients pay more for the exact same thing at the same hospital, with the same doctors, with the same services, and it's completely unjustified.
Which puts all of the onus on the patient, us as consumers, to do all this investigative work, because
It does. That's right. And I want to mention the subtitle of the book, because the title of the book is obviously very provocative. Never Pay the First Bill. The subtitle, though, is And Other Ways to Fight the Healthcare System and Win. And I really try and focus in the book as much as I can on the winning. It's a how-to guide that shows you the tactics that will help you and your family save hundreds or even thousands of dollars with every single healthcare interaction. I'm really on a mission to improve the healthcare system literacy of Americans so they can see all of these pitfalls, all of these hidden traps that the healthcare system has set up for us, and how to navigate around those, and how to fight back and stand up for yourself. Because unfortunately, it's not fair, but we have been put in a very difficult position here, mm-hmm. where we have to defend ourselves.
Yes, it can be such a predatory system. Now, another piece of advice you have, Marshall, is don't just take every treatment that doctors are incentivized to offer you, right?
That's right. That's right. Sometimes it seems really intimidating, right, to look up a bill and understand what it is, or contest a bill if they're not going to back down. Like, I even have a chapter in the book on how to sue in small claims court to defend yourself. A lot of people aren't going to want to do that level of confrontation, right? They're going to be afraid of it. But one easy thing that we can do is avoid unnecessary treatment. And what we need to realize here is that doctors are usually paid on a fee-for-service system. That means they get paid for doing stuff. I mean, that's the lay term for it. And so they might recommend a treatment or a drug or a test because they get paid to do it, or a lab will get paid to run a test. Well, that test might not be necessary for you. And so the key question I recommend people ask, and I have a whole chapter about this, but if you just want one key question, ask your doctor if it's a discretionary thing that the doctor's recommending. Ask what will happen if you don't do that right now. So if they're saying you need a test or a procedure or a drug, say, hey, what's the risk? Rather than just telling me the risk of doing it and why I should do it, let's change the conversation and talk about what would happen if I didn't do it. Am I going to die right now? Am I going to infect someone with some disease? Is something going to grow inside me? Or could we wait? Could we take 3 months and see how I'm doing at that point? Is there a less expensive way to handle this? And then maybe do some research on your own. Get a second opinion. Make sure that that service that you're getting is absolutely necessary, because they say that up to 25% of all the treatment given to American patients is unnecessary. And so imagine if we could just cut 25% right now off of our healthcare costs. we would all be saving thousands of dollars a year.
That's incredible. All right, let's talk about insurance for a minute, because so often, even with the advent of the Affordable Care Act, people can't access treatments that they need because their insurance plan doesn't always cover them. You provide a roadmap for how to appeal to your insurer and try to get them to cover treatments that are necessary. And that can be difficult.
It can be very difficult. And I think if I had to give one piece of advice for that process, your agreement with your insurance company is a contract. And so when you're appealing to your insurance plan, whether it's an employer-funded plan where you actually have to involve your employer, or whether it's a fully insured plan where it's just you taking on the insurance company, our temptation is to make an emotional appeal, right? Because this is ruining our lives. Maybe our loved ones, our kids' lives depend on getting this test or treatment, and the insurance plan is denying it. So we want to make an emotional appeal. But the insurance plan is thinking of this like a contract. So you have to use the terms and the insurance company's requirement to comply with that contract in your appeal to that insurance plan. And this is more complicated. I go through it in the book about how to do it. So obviously people can refer to the book. The other thing I want to emphasize to people, I want to ask people to go to my website if they want more information. My website is marshallallen.com. Mm-hmm. You can sign up for my newsletter. And stay tuned, because to follow the book, I'm creating a health literacy video curriculum that people will be able to take all of this information in short 3 to 5 minute videos. And my goal is to couple that with the book so that people can get a quick understanding of a lot of these principles and a lot of these how-to tactics, so they can be empowered to take on the system and win.
That's the key, empowering yourself with information. Thank you so much. He is award-winning ProPublica reporter Marshall Allen, covering the healthcare industry for years, and his book is a must for anyone who wants better healthcare at a lower price. It's called Never Pay the First Bill and Other Ways to Fight the Healthcare System and Win. Check it out, pick it up, and check out his website too, marshallallen.com. Thanks, Marshall.
Speaking of healthcare, UNF is among 15 winners of the first Research Accelerator grants provided by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. This will help the university study the direct and indirect impacts of COVID-19. Dr. Cynthia Williams is Public Health Associate Professor at UNF. Dr. Williams, good morning.
Good morning.
This is exciting that the Gates Foundation is giving UNF funds to study COVID. What will the study encompass?
Well, it's a great opportunity, and we are so appreciative. The purpose of the study is to really study the factors such as demographics, socioeconomics, and health behaviors of vulnerable populations. We really want to ensure that telehealth is accessible to everyone. And so the results of the study will be used to inform culturally sensitive programs that will help us specifically target vulnerable populations, so to ensure that they do have access to telehealth, similar to everyone. We really do want mm-hmm. to promote health equity with the study.
Certainly, we've all seen the benefits of telehealth through this crazy time we've lived through. But you're going to be looking at social determinants of health and barriers to accessing this kind of health care. Is that right?
Yeah, so we will be looking at demographic factors and other factors, community factors, as you mentioned, social determinants of health. Those are important factors that we know are inhibitors in the traditional system. And so we want to ensure that as we, you know, aggressively adopt telehealth for all of the great reasons, not only the public health crisis that we are experiencing, but after this crisis, that the policies that we continue to put forth, even the present policies that promote telehealth, will not deepen health inequities in our society.
Now, this grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation will allow you at UNF to access and use the data in the COVID-19 research database. 250 million patients, 85 billion records in this database. It's the largest repository in the world that's being made available to public health researchers studying this pandemic. How big a coup is that for you at UNF?
Well, it's just an awesome opportunity to not only to have access to this type of data, such a large data set with many, many variables and so many things that we're able to examine. But, you know, so we're so grateful for the COVID-19 research database and, you know, this public-private consortium is really providing great opportunities for researchers such as myself and our university to really be impactful in the community.
And this is a study that I think would have implications everywhere, but will you be studying the local population in Duval County to get your findings?
Actually, we'll be studying the database. So
the whole database.
Several databases that we'll be looking at in there. But in terms of geography, we are looking at the entire United States. And so we're looking to look at everyone who has the opportunity to use telehealth and to see what their utilization patterns are and what contributes to that utilization, or better yet, what distracts from that, and how can we promote utilization in our society. So not only does that have implications for us here locally in Jacksonville, but in the state of Florida, but also has implications for other places around the world.
And I would think the digital divide is a big barrier, just not having the technology to Zoom with your doctor.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, as we look again at traditional system and the barriers that are there, but when we add that extra layer of technology and kind of think about those who don't have access to technology, or those that don't have access to the sophisticated technology that allows for some telehealth platforms to really be effective. You know, even if we have individuals that only have access to audio, that prohibits types of provider-patient interaction, as opposed to those that have the internet bandwidth to be able to have more live interactive. So we want to ensure that everybody has similar access and they're able to access similar types of care, and we haven't relegated particular populations to perhaps lower levels of technology than others.
Now, you're starting the research this summer, and you'll be featured in a webinar series later this year with some of the other national grant winners. Is that right?
Yeah, so that will be a great opportunity for us to discuss our studies and to see what other researchers are looking at similar data. And I think the interdisciplinary comprehensive perspective will really go a long way to not only look at our country and internationally around COVID, but how do we move forward from a public health perspective.
Congrats, and we look forward to the findings. Dr. Cynthia Williams, Public Health Associate Professor at UNF. We'll have to follow up with you later this year. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And up next, it's called The Most Instagrammable Place in Town, a look inside the new Selfie World Jax. Next.
We played a game.
Now you can see what happens here. Okay, what happens in these supply chains is somebody gets nervous and orders more.
I'm Kimberly Adams. Beer, a game, and global supply chains. Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Robin Young. Summer of Soul revisits the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival, which had a spectacular lineup and turnout. The Fifth Dimension's Marilyn McCoo remembers.
Seeing the audience, seeing the families, seeing the excitement on their faces.
Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, an inside look at the Nixon White House in a critical period of the Watergate scandal. We talk with historian Michael Dobbs, who relies on the most recently released tape recordings to chronicle the drama as Nixon aides turned on each other and eventually the president. Dobbs' new book is called King Richard. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
After the remains of more than 200 children were discovered at what was once Canada's largest Indigenous residential school, the U.S. government is investigating its own boarding school program.
Only by acknowledging the past can we work toward a future that we're all proud to embrace.
We'll hear more about the work being led by America's first Indigenous cabinet secretary next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. It's called the most Instagrammable place in Jacksonville. The new Selfie World Jax is open this month. Co-owner Asa Moss is on the line now with details. Asa, good morning and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm great, thanks. So I've been seeing a lot about this on social media. Tell us about Selfie World.
Sure. So Selfie World is, if you took like an interactive art exhibit and combined photography with it, I think that would best describe Selfie World.
How'd you come up with this space? It's basically a place where you can come be your own photographer, right?
Yeah, and well, we also have professional photographers that come in and shoot photos with their clients. We've had a baby moon, which I just learned what that is. That's where you go take... go have a little fun trip with your significant other before the new baby comes. We've had all kinds of people come through there. We've had parties and team building events. We've got stuff scheduled for field trips, for summer camps, for local students. A cheerleading squad's going to come through and do a team building event. So there's all kinds of activities available.
So how does it work exactly? Paint a picture for us. Give us a selfie, okay. I guess a selfie in our minds of what we'll see when we come into Selfie World.
Sure. So when you come in, we get you checked in and get you set up and teach you on how to use our ring lights. We have a large ring light / tripod that you can mount your phone on. So you have good professional lighting for all your photos. And then we have over 20 photo opportunities throughout the store that you can go through with different backgrounds and different scenes. So, like, you know, anything from a 50s diner to our slinky room. To we have swings in there with Live Colorfully, neon on the wall. We have a swimming pool in the back. It's a ball pit, but it looks like a swimming pool. And, you know, all these different scenes and setups. For you to come in and take photos, and you get an hour and to come in and take all the photos that you want. And additionally, for a $5 charge, we have a Revo Spin, which is a 360-degree platform that does this amazing slow-motion 360 video of you while you're in there.
Now, you also are showing sensitivity to kids and adults with sensory issues, people on the autism spectrum and others. Your daughter helped you create a special booth in Selfie World called the Sensory Booth. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, we had started this business with her in mind. She's 16 now. She has autism. We had looked at vocational options for her in the future. And, you know, it's something that'll come up for any parent. Wondering what the future holds for your kids. And so then it kind of became like a passion of ours, especially my wife's, to create a space where we could employ people with disabilities to where they are performing the same tasks as their neurotypical or typical counterparts. And we really wanted to do that. This came up actually on my wife's TikTok feed. And
oh, really?
And yeah, it was a viral video she saw of Selfie World. And, you know, she gained interest in it and it kept popping up. So it was meant to be. And as a matter of fact, one of her friends opened one at another location. So it is a franchise.
I see.
Selfie World is. So we jumped in, and it's been great.
It's taking over the world. Okay, so the grand opening is it this Saturday, or can people already go and check out Selfie World Jacks?
It was this past Saturday.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think this says about our culture now, that so much of what we're doing is online and on Instagram and other sites?
Well, and it's funny because I've actually had this conversation before. I think that the term selfie has kind of replaced portrait now. You know, like I said, we've had models come through with professional photographers, and it's very much just a modern photo studio. But I think it's great that we've had, you know, we have these shareable experiences because of social media. So even though I'm not, you know, a young kid, I still support it. I think it's great. It's definitely a positive experience. We see nothing but smiles coming out, and that doesn't hurt nowadays.
Yeah, we can certainly use that. Selfie World Jacks is open. They are on San Jose Boulevard. Check them out at selfieworldjacks.com. That's spelled WRLD. And bring your friends. Thank you so much, Asa Moss. He is the co-owner of the new Selfie World Jacks. Have fun with it.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. And producer Heather Schatz, she visited Selfie World yesterday. Thought it was a lot of fun. Director Josh Torres, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield, our digital editor, also part of what we do here at the station. Keep those emails coming. We value your feedback. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And check out our podcast, up later today, wherever you like to listen. You can always listen through the WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.